Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 704, Interview with John Loftus. This program is being recorded on February 21st of the year 2010. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves someone that I consider to be a genuine American hero, and veteran listeners know I don't hand out praise lightly. John, welcome back to our airwaves.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. It's good to be back. God, we've done so many shows for so long.
And it's been, time flies when you're having fun, I guess. It's been over a year since we've had you here, and there's been an awful lot of, there have been a lot of things going on. Why don't we start out just off the cuff, what are your feelings about President Obama's first year in office?
I think that all presidents find out you have to govern from the center. And Obama has made that shift very rapidly. That's caused a lot of wounds among his progressive friends, let's be honest. Okay, they've been very disappointed. I am not disappointed at all. I think he made the moves he had to do. If anything, if Obama had switched his priorities and gone to the economic jobs subsidies first and health care in the second year of administration, he probably would have been better off. Because, let's be blunt, Republicans give 80% more money, get more money from the pharmaceutical lobbies or from the med lobbies than the Democrats for a reason. Republicans have sold themselves out. And, you know, Obama is never going to get any kind of bipartisan consensus on health care because the Republican Party has sold its soul. I'm sorry, but that's the blunt, honest truth. I wish that it were different, but it isn't. So Obama took a lot of grief over health care in his first year, and time that, you know, he probably should have been expending on something else. And I think there would have been a consensus right away for a jobs program, whether it was, you know, CCC camps or let's fix all the nation's highways and bridges or something like that. That could have been done. I think as outrageous as it is for Obama to have put the money first into the bankers and the corrupt insurance companies, that had to be done. It was a necessary evil. The alternative was the Japanese approach. When the Japanese real estate bubble burst, they refused, out of a sense of outrage, to bail out those companies and banks that had caused it. Instead, they had a recession that lasted 10 years. So the Japanese told Obama's advisors, no matter what you do, don't do what we did. Throw money at it, throw it anywhere, but dump it all up front in the first year. And maybe then your recession will only last a year or two. And now people are saying that the recession seems to be ending, that it may be turning around, that the horrible negative indicators are shrinking each month in terms of unemployment and things like that. So it may have been a necessary evil that Obama tackled the biggest problem, which was stabilizing the capital markets first. And but, you know, that was obviously, many people felt, was a betrayal of both the progressive and maybe even the left moderate wing of the Democratic Party. But I think it had to go in that order. I think if he had gone right from the banks to making jobs for the working man, boy, he would have been much more popular, and then tackle health care in the second year. Because I think the voting public recognizes that the Republicans are sabotaging the health care program, but they don't care right now. Health care is not their priority. It's jobs. I think that was a strategic error, but it's just my guess.
Well, of course, there was a very real possibility of a global financial meltdown, too. It had some of these disgusting institutions not been bailed out.
It's the second Great Depression. We were absolutely on the brink. And if you don't believe me, ask the people of Greece.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, some of us, yeah.
And Ireland, you know, those two countries are in serious, serious financial problems.
And Spain and Portugal, you know, it's scary.
Yeah.
How about
and Obama may have rescued the world. And the irony is, and I hate to say this, but the Saudis actually did something good. The Chinese were getting ready to switch from the dollar to a euro-denominated currency. And the Saudis said to them, if you do that, if you dump the dollar, it's going to hurt us because we Saudis have most of our investment in the dollars. And if you do that, we Saudis will guarantee that you will never get a drop of Arab oil again. And the Chinese blanched, but the Saudis meant it. So the Chinese have agreed that if the Americans turn a blind eye and let them float the phony renminbi currency, you know, for a few years more, that the Chinese will not crash the dollar.
Interesting.
So the Saudis have also agreed with the Chinese that what they will do is the Saudis will keep pumping extra oil to keep the price of oil below $80 a barrel, which is two things. It's good for the Chinese to keep oil prices low because they're an oil importing country. And second, it's for the Saudis' survival thing, because if oil drops below $80 a barrel, the government of Iran is slowly going bankrupt. It's killing them. And every other Arab country is going along with it because they agree that, you know, Iran, the Iranian regime has to go, and no one wants to fight the war. I mean, the Israelis and Americans will do it as a matter of last resort, but neither the Americans nor the Israelis are crazy about that idea right now.
Sure.
So the Saudis have saved the American currency, and they're strangling the Iranian government. So I hate to say it, but for once, the Saudis have done something good.
And this comes from an individual, you, John, that has expended
a long history of attacking Wahhabism and the Saudis,
And including numerous appearances on this broadcast in which you've laid out just exactly who and what they are and their Nazi and fascist history with the Muslim Brotherhood.
It's terrible. I mean, the Saudis loved Hitler. I mean, I had read copies of the letters of diplomatic correspondence where the Saudis were asking, we're going to send guns to Hitler and give Hitler access to Saudi oil. And so, you know, FDR's intelligence service found out about it from the British oilmen, who were very upset, and they worked out a deal. That's how Saudi Arabia became the only neutral country in history ever to get lend-lease support during World War II. Essentially, all our lend-lease money that went to the Saudis was a bribe to pour cement into the tops of their oil wells and not sell it to the Nazis.
By the way, this is covered for newer and younger listeners, if they would like to pursue this. This and a great many other very eye-opening and pivotally important pieces of information and history are available in the book, The Secret War Against the Jews, that John co-authored with Mark Ahrens. And it's just a remarkable book. I think one of the reasons the book has not maybe sold better than it did, John, is just the title. There are so many people going, oh, Jews, I don't like Jews. I don't want to read about Jews. It really is about oil and fascism and the power elites of America and much of the rest of the world.
The irony was by taking the case study of Israel, you got to have a real good a drilling sample, if you will, of the hypocrisy of our Middle Eastern policy going back 100 years. That, you know, most Americans support Israel, you know, and we keep electing congressmen and senators and send more of our tax dollars to Israel than more than any other place on the planet. You know, we're not the problem. We generally support Israel as a beachhead democracy in a very troubled region. Mm-hmm. The problem is our State Department and our intelligence community and our Justice Department have all said whatever the American people might say about liking Jews in public, it really is in America's long-term national interest to obtain the cheap and consistent supply of oil. The Arabs have it, the Jews don't. It's as simple as that. It's not about conspiracy or bigotry. It's about economy. If Moses had turned right and settled in Kuwait, we would have made Israel the 51st state.
Yeah, it's a remarkable book. You know, John, one thing I'd like to touch, there are a lot of things I'd like to touch on, including, try to haul me back to this. I'd like to get your impressions of Obama's first year vis-a-vis national security matters. But we actually have not talked about the secret war against the Jews in some years. And there is so much in there, having just come out of 2 years of a Bush 2 administration. One of the things you go into is the history. It's relatively well known at this point, but maybe not as much as it should. You go into the history of the Bush family and where they fit into the development of fascism and also the power politics of oil in the post-World War II period.
And I should tell you that the first book, The Ballard Secret, I'm doing a remake of that, and that's coming out this year. And I'm going to be doing two things in the new edition. I'll list all the things that were censored out of the first book. And I think The Ballard Secret has the distinction of being the only book in American history ever to go through the censorship process twice. It was interesting on all the things that were taken out, and I'll be able to talk with you about that in a second. But the other point is that I'm going to talk about something I've never talked before. My first boss in the Justice Department, in the Office of Special Investigations, this is way back during the Carter era, was a guy named Walter Rockler, and Walter had been one of the banker's prosecutors for the Nuremberg War Trials. And Walter hired me, I was the first person he hired for the new Nazi war crimes, because I had intelligence training as an Army officer. The bottom line was that Walter knew that Nuremberg was fixed. He hated that word, but what he said was that the funding dried up and he had to choose between which bank to prosecute. So he dropped the Deutsche Bank and Herman Abbs, the head of the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Supposed to and the very next day, the British hired Abbs as their economic advisor in the British saw. And then Abbs eventually almost became the Vatican economic advisor until the Wiesenthal people stepped in. But what Walter did was he preserved a little tiny bit of history. He stole a document out of the Nazi files before it could be burned, and it listed 13 American banks that were secretly financing the Third Reich, where Nazi money moved back and forth. And so Walter asked if I would help him follow the money. So they could fix Nuremberg, then our job, 40 years later with Nazi war criminals would be a farce unless we found out who was doing this and why. So in my update to the Belarus secret, which first came out, it must have been 1982,
mm-hmm.
but right after I did the 60-minute show, it caused an uproar, saying that there were Nazis in America, and Congress demanded hearings. Mike Wallace got the Emmy Award. My family got the death threats. It was a great trade-off. But for legal reasons, because I was an attorney at the headquarters of the Justice Department, I could not reveal how much had been censored out. And a lot of it was about the money. So I'm doing an update of the Belarus Secret, the new book coming out this year by Trine Day Publishers, some of the, real rebels that are probably well-known to the Pacifica readers.
And actually, we've accessed a couple of them. They published Daniel Hopsicker's book,
yeah,
Welcome to Terrorland,
yeah.
And also Ed Haslam's book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. So it's a publisher that's familiar to this audience.
Yeah. So Trine Day, get an advance copy. My new book is going to be called America's Nazi Secret, okay?
Okay.
And it is going to go through, a brief summary about the men who funded Hitler. And it's both Republicans and Democrats, by the way. One of the neocons, Ken Timmerman, wrote describing his book as the pugnacious John Loftus that attacks both Republicans and Democrats equally. Well, I don't really attack people because of their party affiliations. I just want to get to the bottom of the truth. And there were people like the Harriman families, one of the most famous Democratic families, that were involved with the Nazis. Primarily, they came from funding the Bolsheviks, and there was a Bolshevik deal with the German industrialists. That they were going to set up a giant manufacturing facility near the borders of Europe and Russia. Now, the problem was the rail lines were different sizes. European rail lines were one gauge, and the Russian trains were much larger. So the idea was they'd bring German high tech, move it into eastern Poland, and they could have a canal dug to connect the Vistula River with Russia. So there'd be enough water for the industrial use. You could bring in raw material by barges. There was a huge coal field next door, and this is the province of Silesia. And the coal could be reprocessed into additives for aviation fuel, for example, which the Russians desperately needed. So this was the secret Hitler-Stalin pact. The Molotov-Ribbentrop pact was the public face of it. This was the secret annex. And these guys were going to make a high-tech facility that would service both Stalin's empire and Hitler's. And they picked the perfect site for it, one next to a coal field on the Vistula River, the eastern part of Poland, right next to the little tiny village in Poland of Oswiecim, better known to the rest of the world as Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's where it gets nasty. The Silesian American Coal Company was run by Prescott Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the grandfather of the President of the United States.
And by the way, John, just a second. The Harrimans, who were one of they were big business partners of the Bushes, and as you noted, primarily affiliated with the Democratic Party,
yes.
They originally made their fortune as some of the robber barons in America in railroads.
Yep, this is it. This goes back to Teddy Roosevelt, when he passed all these antitrust and anti-monopoly and anti-cartel rules. The robber barons were furious. The Harrimans were big railroad thieves, and they helped the Rockefellers to establish, monopolies all across. The idea was if you own the railroads, you can squeeze, manipulate commodity prices. It was wildly illegal under today's law, certainly morally corrupt. But when Teddy Roosevelt passed legislation, trust-busting laws, to forbid this type of predatory pricing, the robber barons of Wall Street had enough political clout to push through a loophole law through Congress. It's called the Webb-Pomeroy Act of 1918. And what it did say was that you had no cartels, monopolies, or trusts in America, but you could do them overseas. And so during the 1920s, all the American invested money the robber barons had went out of the United States and got dumped into three different countries. They financed a group of radical Arab terrorists called the Wahhabis and had them steal the holy capitals of Mecca and Medina so that the American Arab oil company could be formed, Aramco. And, of course, that's how the House of Saud was formed. Now, the House of Saud, House of Bush is a very good book if you haven't read that. Something I recommend to your readers.
Yeah, we have used it on the broadcasts in the past. Tell us about. I know I don't want to interrupt the narrative, John, but tell us about Bridger St. John, a.k.a. Jack Philby.
Yeah, Jack Philby was a genuine fascist. He was such a dangerous pro-Nazi guy. The British victims were imprisoned during World War II for what? He converted to Islam, and he became the go-between for setting up this horrible connection between the Dulles brothers, who were the clients for the American investors. And, you know, the guns came in. Alan Dulles was a State Department intelligence operative. So we propped up. We hired a group of terrorists, the Wahhabis, to establish the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And then the first thing we did was using Jack Philby was to set up this, you know, sort of pro-fascist, American-owned oil consortium. And, of course, Jack Philby's son was Kim Philby, who was so horrified by his dad's Nazi contract that Kim became a spy for the communists. So anyway, the Wahhabis, the Saudis, were the first group they hired. But then the Harrimans funded the Bolsheviks. Totally illegal. Americans weren't supposed to finance this early communist uprising, but they did it because the Tsar's economic system was based on cartels, and the Bolsheviks would continue the cartels, and that was the deal they cut with the Harrimans. And the Harrimans were also part of their partners in crime, if you will, were the Thyssens, the major industrialists in Germany. And the Thyssens were secretly financed by the robber barons as well. And that's where the Herbert Walker and George Bush and the Rockefeller money all came in. So it was a nasty little system. These guys didn't care whether it was communists or Nazis that came to power. All they cared about was that they had a terrorist group in the hip pocket to protect their investments. And the terrorist group in Germany, of course, was the Nazi Party. And these guys funneled money into a bankrupt Germany to build the Bauernhaus in Munich, the first Nazi Party headquarters, to fund Hitler's organization. Indeed, their primary client, Thyssen, wrote a book, I Financed Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
They really did this stuff, folks. And so when World War II came around, these were guys that were going to make a profit off the war. So they built Auschwitz, not as a killing center originally, but as an industrial center. This was supposed to be the great alliance between their clients, between their Russian clients and their German clients. And but the problem was, of course, that Hitler, you know, they thought he was a dog on a leash to keep the labor unions and the communists at bay and let the capitalists prosper. But Hitler, you know, was a dog that broke his chain. And Hitler's finance minister was Hallmar Schacht, who was born in Brooklyn and was a good friend of the Dulleses.
His middle name was Horace Greeley, Hallmar Horace Greeley Schacht.
Yeah, and, you know, people don't believe that the early communist propaganda about the American capitalist plot to take over the world, there was a good bit of truth to that. These guys were sharks, but it wasn't a conspiracy. It's just that there were a bunch of sharks swimming in parallel lines going after the bloody victims of World War I. And they took all these bloody nations and exploited them, and horrible oppression of the peoples. But they built the Stalinist empire and Hitler's empire at the same time. So during the same period of the early 20s, you see the Saudi empire and oil being built, the Stalinistic empire, and the Hitler's Nazi empire being built.
And by the way,
all tremendously profitable.
To this day, Sullivan and Cromwell, the old Dulles law firm, is the general counsel for the Saudi bin Laden group, to bring it up to something that younger listeners might be familiar with.
These groups, for example, the Arab Nazi group is something I focus on a lot now. The Arab Nazis started in 1928. They're founded by an Egyptian nationalist named Hassan al-Banna. It's B as in boy, A-N-N-A. You can Google them. Just type in Nazi and Banna, and you'll see astonishing articles come out. Banna was a real devotee of Adolf Hitler, and Banna wanted to set up an Arab version of the Nazi Party called the Muslim Brotherhood. Hitler thought it was great. And he assigned it to his intelligence service during the 30s, and the Muslim Brotherhood became the best program of the Third Reich's intelligence service. They had 500,000 Arab members, and including, this is very important, all the Arab states in the southern part of the Soviet Union, all the stans, okay, were infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, all the way through. And Hitler wanted to open up a new southern front in Russia that would depend on a Muslim uprising. Now, the ambassador from the Muslim Brotherhood to Hitler was a guy named
Haj Amin al-Husseini.
You got him. And he was the second cousin Arafat, but more importantly, he was the original Arab Nazi, if you will, Palestinian fascist, met personally with Hitler. This is amazing. Hitler sat this little Palestinian guy down and briefed him on Hitler's plans to kill every Jew in Europe. And then the Grand Mufti would say, and then will you send the Einsatzgruppen to us in Palestine so we can kill all the Jews, and we'll march through North Africa and wipe out the Jews there. Hitler said, yes, they would do it. That's the plan. And Hitler's aide to Stalin said, my Führer, why would you give such an important state secret to this Arab? And Hitler said, because they support our views so enthusiastically. So Eichmann actually took the Grand Mufti on a tour through the killing centers at Auschwitz and to actually cheer the guards on, to encourage them to greater and greater heights of massacres against the populations. And it was in the war, the Muslim Brotherhood was regarded as one of the most wanted groups of war criminals in the world. And they all disappeared. And the simple answer was that Jack Philby and Kim Philby had conned the British government saying, look, if you want to own all the oil regions and keep them under your control, hire this group of Arab Nazis. And the first thing they'll do for you is kill the Jews. So the Muslim Brotherhood was sent by the British Secret Service in 1948 to attack the infant state of Israel and strangle it in its birth. Now, the Jews thought that was not a good idea, defeated the Muslim Brotherhood, and they retreated back into Egypt. Now, here's where it gets funny. The Arab Nazis are still pretty large. They're 750,000 registered members of the Muslim Brotherhood at this point, but they're licking their wounds. The secular government of Egypt is leftist, and they don't want this right-wing army in their midst. They expel the Muslim Brotherhood and throw them out or destroy them.
And this, by the way, because a lot of our listeners are too young to remember this, and sadly our educational system doesn't really do the job it should, but this was under Gamal Abdel Nasser in the early 50s that the Brotherhood was expelled from Egypt. Go ahead.
Nasser found a way to kill two birds with one stone, and Nasser wanted American funding. Now, Alan Dulles was in line to become the new head of the CIA when Eisenhower was elected, and Eisenhower was going to appoint the other Dulles brother, John Foster Dulles, as Secretary of State. So the Dulles brothers went to their friends, the Saudis, and begged the Saudis to become the place of refuge for the Arab Nazi movement, the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Saudis loved this. I mean, they said this supported Hitler in the first place anyway. And so they said, yep, resettle all the members of the Muslim Brotherhood here. And so they did, and the Saudis had jobs for them because the Muslim Brotherhood members were, by and large, educated. And so the Saudis hired, put the Arab Nazis in charge of their school system. And all the madrasas in Saudi Arabia were run by the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, for example, the brother of the chief Nazi propagandist, Sayyid Qutb, his brother Muhammad Qutb, was the personal tutor for a young man called Osama bin Laden.
Really? Because I know Sayyid, well, the one Qutb who wrote the book Milestones, actually after he, or was it Signposts, but after he toured the United States, but his brother was the personal tutor to Osama bin Laden?
Yep. And Qutb is to this day the founding justifier of the sect against Islam. There's a heresy called Salafiyya Jihadiyya. And what it means is that anyone can declare war, a holy war, a jihad, And prior to Khatib's book, it was only holy work could only be declared by the Ummah or the Caliph. The Caliph, of course, ended with the fall of the Turkish government in World War I. And the Ummah meant a consensus of the community, a very sort of democratic, consensual approach, a Shura Council kind of thing. But Khatib says, no, we don't want to bother with democracy. Democracy is our enemy. Western civilization is our enemy. Jews are our enemy. Christians are our enemies. Jihad can be declared by any individual. And he wrote up this horrible, berserk cult thing, and it was actually endorsed only by the Saudis, of course, because Wahhabism was itself declared a heresy by the Ummah, by the Arab community, more than 60 times before 1900. And once the Saudis had oil, they wanted to buy respectability. So you had a perfect storm of hatred. You had this Saudi religious bigotry in the form of Wahhabism married up with the Muslim Brotherhood's Arab Nazi racism. And so when you think about it, the Muslim Brotherhood was the parent organization of all the Sunni-based terrorist groups. And, you know, when modern counter-terrorists describe them as Islamo-fascists, I think that's wrong, because these are actually just second-generation fascists. Their daddies were the original members of the Arab Nazi Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, which still exists. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood's representative was, of course, I said, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. And by tradition, the Palestinian representation is one of the leading members of the Grand Mufti. And so the group today in Palestine that is their representative of the Muslim Brotherhood is something called Hamas, which evolved in the 1970s. Really, it's just sort of a new branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. But whoever is the head of Hamas is also the Muslim Brotherhood rep.
By the way, the listeners can access the charter of Hamas and a number of the descriptions to these programs. And it, as I've commented, when in the programs at which I accessed it and read it, it's just straight, undiluted Nazi ideology. It went from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion onto the Rotary Club and the Lions Club, or secret Zionist fronts, which I'm sure will come as a lot of news.
Dave, a lot of our friends on the left are going to be shocked by this because they think it's some sort of right-wing propaganda that Hamas was a second-generation Nazi group. I mean, to this day, they still give the Nazi salute. Well, that could be a coincidence. But when you look at, who was the guy in the wheelchair, the head of Hamas that the Israelis assassinated? His obituary ran in the Egyptian papers, they admitted that he was the head of the Muslim Brotherhood in the area.
John, we are almost out of time on this side. Let's continue this on side two. Very quickly, your website and radio program.
My radio program is called the Loftus Report, and the website is johnloftusreport.com.
And soon to be coming out with a second edition of The Ballara Secret, which was the very first volume with which my listeners became familiar with you back in the early 1980s, almost 30 years ago. So we had time flies when you're having fun.
It sure is. This will be called America's Nazi Secret, and it will be out this summer from Trine Day Publications.
Very good. We have been visiting with John Loftus, the author of The Ballara Secret, America's Nazi Secret, Unholy Trinity, and The Secret War Against the Jews. And also, I've forgotten the name offhand of the novel, the realistic novel based on the Dulles family.
The Witness Tree, and there will never be an American version, we found out. It is much too embarrassing to the Bush family to have a book written about what they did. So that's why we've been secretly working on a film version to be released in theaters. Well, I'll tell you about that when we come back.
All righty. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 704, interview with John Loftus, being recorded on February 21st of 2010. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.